Today on Vox Talks Economics, what's driving the populist vote? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics.
Europeans will be voting in parliamentary elections in June, and
the upcoming European elections rank among the most important simply because
far-right and ultra-conservative forces could make big gains.
We bring out this week's episode on the eve of EU elections across Europe and later this year. Of course, you might have noticed there's a closely fought election in the United States. As traditional political right-left allegiances break down, what's influencing the way we vote? Andrés Rodríguez Posse of LSE is one of the authors of two new papers that investigate inequality, both regional and interpersonal, as a driver of the populist vote. I visited him recently at the London School of Economics to talk about how the feeling and the economic reality of being left behind has changed the way Europeans and Americans vote. I started by asking him about the increase in numbers of Eurosceptic votes in Europe.
Eurosceptic vote has always existed, but it has become far more prominent. And in national elections in the last 20 years, it has risen from, if we look at hard Eurosceptic votes, from levels of about 3% to about 13 to 14%. It would put mild Eurosceptic vote, it has gone from 10 to 11% to more than 28%. So we're talking already, we're getting close to one third of vote in national elections going to Eurosceptic parties. What has changed is that inequality seems to be rising among other factors. I mean, there are many factors, but inequality is an important one. And it has become pervasive. We had in the post-war period a significant decline in inequality, both interpersonal and interterritorial, but that all changed since the 1980s, and especially since the financial crisis of post-2007 and 2008. And importantly, this inequality has become long-term and pervasive. Places that fall into a development trap are places that very often stay there for very, very long.
Yes, but it's been inequality, and that's been recognized as a problem for 30 or 40 years now. It's this idea that people are falling into long-term traps. Is that the difference?
Well, I think the difference is that when you have a bad year, then you think it's a bad year and things are going to get better the year after. When you have 5 years in which you're going south, when you start facing lack of dynamism for 10, for 15 years, then you start saying, well, there's no solution for us, we're being overlooked. And then you react. And you react by exacting revenge on those that you think have overlooked your needs and your plights. And the problem is that in the analysis that we do in these papers and in other papers, the longer the duration of stagnation, the higher the level of inequality and the longer it lasts, the bigger the reaction. And we have found that economic decline, especially at territorial level, can be traced in Europe in many places for at least 30 years. In the US, we have done it since the 1970s.
Now, we both use this phrase, development trap. What is the development trap?
The development trap is a concept that I have put forward with colleagues like Simona Iannarino, Michael Storper, and Andreas Diemer, which is derived from the concept of the middle income trap. It refers to places that have been losing economic dynamism and are facing stagnation in income, in employment and productivity, relative to themselves in the past, relative to the rest of the country where they're in, and in the case of the European Union, relative to the rest of the European Union. So it's a composite measure to actually consider economic decline going beyond just economic growth.
And in Europe, where do we find these development traps?
In Europe, we have 60 million people today living in regions that have levels of GDP that are lower than they were in the year 2000.
Wow.
135 million, or one third of the population of the European Union, living in regions where there has been barely any growth. That's a significant number. And most of these people tend to be concentrated in development trap regions in most of Italy, in Greece, in parts of Croatia, and most of the area of the north of France outside Paris.
In your research, you examine the influence of these development traps on votes cast for Eurosceptic parties. But how do you decide how Eurosceptic a political party is? Where do you get that information?
Well, the beauty of this is, and in order to avoid controversy, is that we don't decide which are the Eurosceptic parties. We rely on the true experts. So we use the Chapel Hill Expert Survey, which is a survey compiled at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in which political scientists are asked, looking at the electoral manifestos and programs of different parties, to rate parties on a spectrum of 0 to 10, depending on their position, anti-elite position, populist position. So there we took, out of a scale to 10, the ones that are in, well, in this case, between 8.5 and 10, so that part of the spectrum, which are at the more extreme, and especially the far right extreme, and we define this as far-right populism.
So which parties would we think of as being in this category?
Well, there's a large range of parties.
There
so we
now
cover the whole of Europe. So we have, I think it's 4 pages of parties there. But just to give you some indication, is the Rassemblement National in France, so the party of Marine Le Pen, the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, so her Wilders, the Lega in Italy with Matteo Salvini. But also you'll have extreme right-wing parties like Jobbik, for example, in the case of Hungary.
What difference does falling into a development trap make to the likelihood of voting for a party like this?
If you fall into a development trap, and this development trap has a high level of intensity and a long duration, people start losing faith in the political system. And that's when the political systems explode, as has been the case in France or in Italy. Just to give you an example, in the last presidential elections, the two grand parties that had dominated the French political panorama since the post-war period, so the Republicans, or the heirs of President Charles de Gaulle, and the Socialists, got a grand total of 7% of the vote. These are people that, after a long time, lose faith completely in the system and decide, we had enough. If the system doesn't work for us, let's make sure that the ones that are not hearing our plights, not paying attention to our problems, suffer in the same way as we're suffering.
Is this something that we see across Europe?
I think there's something that is very strongly reflected in our research, that the stronger and the deeper the trap, the higher the Eurosceptic vote, but not just Eurosceptic, the higher the stream of vote. And this is commensurate, and it increases in a way that is more than incremental. The longer the duration of the trap, and the higher the intensity of the trap.
So if you stay in the trap, and I guess the whole point of a trap is it something that you do stay in, then that vote just keeps increasing?
Well, you can get out of the trap. But the problem is that in the case of Europe, what we find is that there are many regions in Europe that, out of a maximum period that we measure of 19 years in a trap, stay a minimum of 17 years. So in Europe, once you fall into a trap, it's very difficult for that place to get out of the trap.
Are you sure that the causal relationship is going from economic deprivation, being in the trap, to voting for Eurosceptic parties? There's not an effect going the other way?
Well, in the paper, what we do is we measure the causality going from economic decline and being in a trap to, in this case, extreme party, so anti-system voting. And we find that it works in that direction. Having said that, it doesn't mean that it cannot work in the other direction. And it's actually very likely, and this is something that we're exploring at the moment, that by voting for anti-system parties with their proposed economic solutions, the economic situation for many of the regions that are in a trap is not going to improve, but in many cases might become worse. And if that is the case, the causality doesn't go in one direction, but it goes in both directions, in which by electing and voting for anti-system parties, you'll have less emphasis on research, less emphasis on innovation, you'll have less inward direct investment, and that might lead to lower economic growth, less employment, lower productivity, that might fuel even greater discontent, actually pushing the problem of economic stagnation further. Once populists are elected, if the population is unhappy, they don't go back to mainstream parties, but they normally vote for even more extreme populists.
We recently discussed the dramatic change in how we vote with Klaus de Smet, who's investigated whether the angriest places also have a higher populist vote. Listen to our episode, Does Anger Drive Populism? First broadcast in October 2023.
Now, your other recent paper compared the influence of interpersonal and regional inequalities on the populist vote. You cover both Europe and the US in this one. We've just been discussing regional decline, that development trap. What's the comparable process here by which there's suddenly some change in interpersonal or regional inequality?
Well, the mechanisms that we find that drive interpersonal and interterritorial inequality are relatively similar. What we have had over the last four decades has been a process of, on the one hand, globalization and more economic integration across the world, with a significant rise of trade, despite the fact that it seems to be starting to go in reverse. And that has fundamentally benefited the world. A very high number of people across the world have moved out of poverty because of the increase in trade. But in the developed world, there's clear evidence that it has hurt a large share of workers, especially the traditional middle classes that seem to be losing out. But that is on top of economic transformations and digital transformations and economic progress that also seem to be hurting the more traditional routine jobs that made the prosperity of most developed societies since the Industrial Revolution. Places that traditionally were hubs of industry in the US Rust Belt, or in the north of England, or in the northeastern France, or in southern Belgium, have lost out. And a lot of the people that were there have lost out as a result. And very often, there's a coincidence of economic decline at the individual level with territorial decline.
And there has been some previous research on this, hasn't there? There was a burst of research in 2016, I recall, for obvious reasons. What has this concluded about the increase in inequality, the idea of being left behind, and how that's driving the populist vote?
There has been a lot of research that burst, especially, as you said, in 2016, the day following the Brexit referendum and also the election of Donald Trump. The research has been coming from very different disciplines. It has been mainly political scientists, economists, geographers as well. Political scientists have put the emphasis on issues linked to culture. So the idea of people that feel ill at ease with a society that has changed, that has become far more cosmopolitan, multiracial, with a higher number of immigrants, that has pushed people to feel like strangers in their own land. Economists have put the emphasis on trade. There's a lot of research coming from David Autor and his collaborators on the so-called China syndrome, and the idea that increasing trade with other parts of the world, epitomized by the case of China, has put a lot of jobs, traditional manufacturing jobs, for products that are now being produced in other parts of the world, fundamentally Far East, in jeopardy, and that has created a reaction. The difference in our research is that we do focus, on the one hand, more on the territorial dimension rather than the individual dimension, although we consider both, and then also that we look at these transformations in the long term from a different perspective, which includes also the development trap.
Do you include any of those social factors that we were talking about before?
Yes, so we do control for quite a lot of factors, because there's also a difference whether these are collective or they are individual. But the emphasis post-Brexit was this is a problem of old, poor, white, and educated men. So what we include is issues like levels of education, the percentage of migrants that are located in a particular territory, the wealth of the individuals, the wealth of the territory that the individual lives in. And we also control for levels of employment to measure opportunities. So we have a whole raft of controls there that most of them work in the direction that previous research has highlighted.
And you're doing this at a local level. How granular can you get?
Well, you can get as granular as you want. I have a previous paper, which is called The Geography of EU Discontent, in which we measure this phenomenon using 64,000 electoral districts in the European Union. In these two papers, what we do is for the US, we use counties. So we have in excess of 3,000 counties for the whole of the United States. And in the case of Europe, we have focus on what are small regions, what are known as the Nuts 3 regions. So depending on the paper and the data available, because measuring interpersonal inequality is problematic in the case of Europe, we range between a bit more than 800 to 1,200 regions across the whole of the EU 27 states.
And when you're looking at these measures of inequality, what data are you using? How are you measuring inequality here?
We use inequality in income, individual level, and we use surveys that are then aggregated, the individual data is aggregated at local level, and this is done county level in the US. In the European Union, we use surveys like, for example, the LIS, the Luxembourg Income Service, and the EU Silk to capture inequality, and then we aggregate the data for the individuals at our regional Nuts 3 level.
So looking at the results from the US, first of all, how big is the influence of this rise in inequality on the populist vote, specifically the Donald Trump vote?
First, I just need to clarify that in the US, we don't measure the Donald Trump vote. What we do measure is the what we call the Trump margin. So is the increase in the vote for Donald Trump relative to the votes a mainstream Republican candidate like Mitt Romney had in 2012. And the US is a very interesting case because in the US, both the rise in interpersonal inequality and also the level of stagnation of counties make a huge difference for the increase in the Trump margin. But this is all mediated by one factor, which is race.
What difference does race make?
Inequalities, both interpersonal and economic decline, matter only in white majority counties. When you have counties that are racially mixed and diverse, levels of inequality or levels of economic stagnation are not connected to the increase in the vote for Donald Trump.
It's quite a remarkable result, isn't it?
Not that much. In fact, race has been a factor that has polarized US politics for a long time, and it was a well-known determinant that the vote for Donald Trump, both in the 2016 and 2020 election, was fundamentally driven by white individuals. So this confirms the situation. Of course, it seems that from recent research and recent polls that the support for Donald Trump is becoming broader and is no longer as driven by the white population in the US as it was in the past. So maybe in the 2024 election that would change, but in the two previous elections, race is a fundamental mediator of the role inequality and decline play in the vote for Donald Trump.
Andres, compare that with what you found from the EU. Is the pattern the same?
No, it's very different. In Europe, we have the problem that we cannot measure race because some countries don't have and don't provide statistics by race. So we substitute the racial component by the percentage of foreign-born in each of the regions. And we find that first, when you put that, there's no mediation. So it doesn't seem to be that sort of connection between, let's say, cultural and economic factors, as in the case of the US. That interpersonal inequality does not make a difference for the vote for Eurosceptic or extreme far-right parties, and that this is fundamentally driven by economic decline or long-term economic decline, and fundamentally by being in a long-term development trap. The results for foreign-born are interesting because what we find is that the number of foreigners living in a place do not affect as a whole vote for Eurosceptic or far-right parties. But if you divide between foreigners born in the European Union and foreigners born outside the European Union, the share of foreigners from other European Union countries actually reduces the vote for Eurosceptic parties, whereas the share of foreigners born outside the European Union is linked to an increase in support for Eurosceptic and far-right parties.
One thing that we haven't really talked about is this whole culture war agenda that's very popular with journalists. It's very often what's talked about in the news as driving this process. And as you say, there has been some other research that has focused on it. Does your research here suggest that maybe we've over-focused on culture wars and underplayed the influence of these very fundamental economic issues?
It doesn't suggest exactly that. Cultural wars matter and cultural factors matter. So having, let's say, a high share of people that feel unease in the places that they live, that feel uncomfortable with the new situation, is an important factor driving discontent. Having said that, the policy solutions are not as straightforward as the economic solutions, because what we are highlighting is that, yes, culture matters, but also economic factors and fundamentally long-term decline matters. So these are places that are voting for Donald Trump or are voting for right-wing extreme parties, or sometimes for left-wing extreme parties as well in the case of Europe, that have fallen through the policy cracks. That we have in Europe a European cohesion policy that has been fundamentally targeting the less developed regions of Europe, and rightly so. Then at national level, what we have is, in theory, spatially blind policies, policies that affect the whole territory, trying to target improvements in education, improvements in productivity, improvements in innovation, sometimes the development through industrial policy, which is becoming far more common, of certain industrial sectors, that when you territorialize that policy, it becomes a policy for the most developed and more dynamic areas. So if you are not poor, but you have levels of income that are the same as they were two or three decades ago, you have no policy catering for you. You are forgotten, you are neglected, and therefore, you feel that by being overlooked, you need to react. And the best way to react is by shaking the whole system. How can we address this? By having policies that look not just at the static dimension, are you poor or are you rich, that are not completely spatially blind, but that target places that have been in an economic decline for a considerable amount of time.
From what you just said, do your economic measures, are they capturing the whole nature of the interpersonal, the regional inequality that we're seeing here? Could we learn more by maybe looking at other measures of inequality as well?
We are just looking at the economic dimension. There are other measures of inequality that are very important. There could be social levels of inequality. So it's not just a question of income, it's a question of where do you stand on the social ladder, how do you have access to opportunities. There's a question of perceptions and feelings. Some of my new research is looking at feeling alone or being alone and how that drives economic performance and eventually how does it change the vote of individuals. So there are a lot of other dimensions of inequality, both objective, but more importantly, even subjective, that require exploration, because there's a whole new world out there that is determining how our society is changing and how the society is changing in ways that until relatively recently we had not imagined.
I don't know if you're going to thank me for this, but we have a tradition of making people policymakers for a day. From this research, if I was going to give you the levelling up portfolio, what policies would you recommend? What policies do you think could have the most impact on this?
You're not putting me in any problems. I am in that situation right now because I have chaired and I'm still in the process of promoting the high level group on the future of cohesion policy. And one of the parts was saying, is the lack of dynamism of many European regions driving not just an economic problem, that we are not mobilizing the whole potential of the European Union, but also creating a serious problem leading to strong disaffection with European integration? And in both cases, the answer has been yes. So we have proposed as a group a series of policy recommendations. But the most important that applies to this is that we have to move beyond the whole issue of targeting and measuring levels of development in a static way. It is very good and it's important that there should be development intervention, there should be a development policy, in this case, the European Cohesion Policy, targeting the less developed regions. But on top, we should have a policy that adopts a dynamic dimension that takes into account long-term stagnation, the presence, the intensity, and the duration of a development trap, because Europe as a whole, and of course I can talk about the US in a moment, cannot afford for, let's say, regions like Piedmont in Italy, or the north of England, or the Nord Pas-de-Calais, the northern parts of France, to become poor, not have the right investment. These are regions that have been at the forefront of development in the past. Some of them were the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. They have not lost their mojo overnight. They still have got potential. And especially in a situation where we are starting to reshore, we need, let's say, greater industrial capabilities. And it is the right time to invest in them, because it's much cheaper to address the problem when it starts than when it becomes entrenched over long periods of time and then might be too late, affecting the whole potential of, in this case, the European Union, because we would not be mobilizing the full talent that we have. Well, in the US, the situation is actually similar. They have a certain advantage relative to Europe, in which regions that fall in a development trap in the US are far more likely to come out of the trap than they do in Europe. Having said that, a place like many parts of West Virginia, many parts of the Rust Belt, some parts of the South, where stagnation has been pervasive and long-lasting. So there, I think what President Biden has done through the different policies, there has been a drive of $80 billion to create industrial policy, but very often this industrial policy has been linked in a more covert way to a territorial policy to try to promote the development and the direction of investment to areas that have been stagnant for quite some time. Probably the effort has come a bit too late. It should have been done not earlier by the Biden administration, but far earlier by both Republican and Democratic administrations. And it has been relatively short of resources, but I think it's the right way to go.
Andres, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The two papers we have been discussing are DP18933, The Geography of EU Discontent and the Regional Development Trap, Andres Rodriguez-Posay, Louis Dijkstra and Hugo Pullman. And DP18923, Left Behind versus Unequal Places, Interpersonal Inequality, Economic Decline, and the Rise of Populism in the US and Europe. And the authors, Andres Rodriguez-Posay, Javier Terrero Davila, and Neil Lee.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. If you liked this episode, why not share it with a friend or colleague? Next week on Vox Talks Economics, which firms are infiltrated by organized crime and why?